Joe. Hey, everyone. On to week one of American Bankster. And like I said, I'll make up two exams for anyone who wants to take a course for a grade. And when you get your certificate of completion online from the Mises Institute at the end of the course, it'll reflect your grade if you want it to. You're not required to take an exam. This is all about learning first and foremost. But it is a good way to challenge yourself and to learn a little more than you otherwise would, I think. And the format is usually that I give about a 45 or 50 minute talk, depending on the subject matter, maybe a little longer, not much shorter usually. And then I'll do Q&A for as long, pretty much as long as anyone wants to do Q&A. Students usually tire out after 20, 30 minutes for that. And we do have, sometimes we do have other classes at Mises Academy in the same night. Every once in a while, I'm not sure what the schedule is tonight, but we'll stick to the time frame of it anyway. And so that's basically the format. And so in terms of the American Bankster, this was really a hallmark of a lot of Murray Rothbard's writing and research. You know, in addition to writing one of the few treatises in economics that's been written in the past 60 years, in a genuine treatise in Austrian economics, Man, Economy, and State. Rothbard's book on the history of money and banking in the United States is also a great treatise. And there aren't too many treatises on money and banking. There's one by Richard Timberlake. There's one by Rothbard. There's one by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz. And there might be one other. I guess Professor De Soto from Spain, I guess we could consider his book to be a treatise. It was published just a couple of years ago, but there aren't that many. And so this is a big part of Murray Rothbard's research agenda. And he used what was sometimes referred to as power elite analysis in his analysis of banking and the effect of banking policy. And so what I thought I would do tonight, though, before we jump into some of the main readings by Rothbard, is I did put one reading by Rothbard on the list. But I think it's important to understand the theoretical underpinnings that that drove Murray Rothbard to conduct the type of analysis that he conducted. And so that's why I put on the syllabus an article by Hans Hoppe on Austrian class analysis, or class exploitation analysis, which is very different than Marxian class analysis, because this is what inspired Rothbard. This was Rothbard's understanding. This is what led him to ask the type of questions he asked, to do the kind of research he did, and to come up with the publications that he came up with. After all, if you were ever to read von Mises' section of Human Action on history, theory, or his book Theory of History, you'd understand that history, the study of history, is sort of irrelevant if all it is a collection of facts. It's maybe not irrelevant, but it really doesn't tell you that much if it's just a jumble of facts. You have to have some sort of lens through which to understand history. And economics, especially Austrian economics, provides an excellent lens through which to view history. But it's not the only one, of course, but a very good one, and Mises was good at that himself. Many of his writings were not just theoretical, but historical as well. And Rothbard, I think, has done better than anybody in the Austrian school in this type of writing, combining theory and history. And certainly in the context of his writings on banking where his most notable achievements were. And so Austrian class analysis is where it starts. That's why I put the article on there. And another point I wanted to make on the first class is that since we're going to be talking about the creation of the Fed eventually in this class, and who was behind it, and who benefited from it at the beginning, and who benefits from it now, and other central banks, not just the American Fed, it's important to understand the context. The historical context in the United States in which the Fed was created was a period of history where big business and big government had finally come together. The Hamiltonian dream. This was the dream of Alexander Hamilton, America's first Treasury Secretary, to have a close relationship between business and government. And economists who have studied the history of economic thought, as Rothbard did, always understood this to mean mercantilism. The old European system of mercantilism in the 17th, 18th centuries was essentially a collection of policies that benefited politically connected businesses and the government at the expense of consumers and everybody else in society. Protectionist tariffs, government grants of monopoly, what we today would call corporate welfare or tax-funded subsidies, central bank to finance corporate welfare, all of this was created in Europe, in England, especially in the Bank of England, in, prior to the 19th century. And this is always was known to economists like Rothbard as mercantilism. And a central bank was always an integral part of that. And so the late 19th, early 20th century in America was a period of really I call it Hamiltonian hegemony. It was really finally the achievement of this insidious goal of the marriage of business and government. And so that's why I put a couple of chapters online from the book In Restraint of Trade by Butler Schaefer, who talks about the World War I era and the New Deal era in the context of business and government conspiring against the public. And so that's an important point, I think, because the Fed was a part of this. The creation of the Fed was just another creation of a government-enforced cartel for the benefit of private businesses. This had been going on for years, and it would continue to go on for years. And so there's no need to look for, I know some people investigate some sort of outside influence, the Rothschilds or somebody like that, and conspiring to foist this Federal Reserve on America. There's no need to look for conspiracy theories of that sort or foreign influences. This sort of thing had been going on in America for decades, and the creation of the Fed was just another natural, inevitable consequence of the rush towards neo-mercantilism that had been going on in America. Really, since the end of the American Civil War in 1865, when government and railroad corporations got together and amassed millions of dollars of subsidies for railroad corporations. So let me start with Austrian class analysis. And Hoppe, in this article that I put on the reading list, really starts out talking about sort of a terse summary of Marxian class analysis. Just as a point of departure, a point of comparison, that whereby the capitalist class is said to exploit the working class because the price of goods that are sold by the capitalist class is higher than the price of wages that are paid to the working class, and the difference was said to be surplus value that was essentially stolen from the workers by the capitalist class. And so there was a lot in Marxism about class consciousness, about why the working class needed to be made conscious of the class that each and every person belonged to so that they could join in and be part of the revolution and overthrow the capitalist system. And that's like in a 10-second soundbite, that's Marxian class analysis. The Marxian theory of exploitation. And of course, there's much more to it. There's the subsistence theory of wages, but that sort of gets a little far afield from our purpose here. And that, of course, has also been proven to be bogus, the subsistence theory of wages, because the working class, of course, increased wages year in and year out once capitalism took hold in Europe and America and anywhere else. But the Austrian exploitation theory is different. It defines exploitation as when someone takes over goods that he has not produced, saved, purchased, or homesteaded. So if some person acquires goods legally and peacefully by either homesteading things that are in nature, purchasing them, saving up, or producing things, and someone steals them from you, that's exploitation. And so exploitation under the Austrian exploitation theory, is people whose property claims are grounded in work and contracts, buying and selling. People who acquired goods through peaceful exchange or through their own work and investments, risk taking, and so forth. When those goods are taken, that's exploitation. And this is a manifestation of libertarian class theory that it was around for centuries. It had been very popular even before Marx and Engels started writing about it in the mid-19th century. And essentially what this means is that the true meaning of exploitation is government is the exploiter. That there cannot really be exploitation per se on the free market as long as there's no force or fraud. As long as I'm not holding a gun to your head, I'm not going to exploit you in any kind of business transaction. And so it's really governments are the only ones that can who forcefully take goods that people have produced, saved, purchased, or homesteaded. And so government is the big exploiter. And not just, and government is defined by, the kings, the princes, the legislators, the presidents, whatever you want to call them, as well as all of their supporters. The government bureaucrats, the government employees, the special interest groups, the benefactors of government spending, people who benefit from government spending and so forth. That's what John C. Calhoun, who was Rothbard's favorite American philosopher, among other things, he was also a politician, defined as two classes being in existence in any democracy, the net taxpayers and the net tax consumers. And inevitably, Calhoun predicted the net tax consumers, people who benefit more from government spending than they pay in taxes, would outnumber and overwhelm politically the net taxpayers. And Hoppe's article and Hoppe's comments are a reflection of this idea that, as I said, existed a long time, even before Marx and Engels. And so exploitation really means government exploitation. And so how does government go about enforcing this? Well, of course, they use violence and the threats of violence. The way I put it to my students is that when government imposes an income tax, it means it claims the right to force you to send men with guns to your house and drag you out of your home and force you to live in a cage that is about 8 feet by 8 feet with a toilet, a sink, and a cot, and no doors for maybe 5 or 6 years if you refuse to pay. That's called going to jail for tax evasion. And so government uses that in other forms of violence, threats, and intimidation. But also, in order to enforce this system, governments always have to wage intellectual war on the ideas of liberalism. And if you want to know what the ideas of liberalism really are, read the book Liberalism by Ludwig von Mises, which is online at Mises.org. It's a good exposition. It was published back in the 1920s, in the early 20s, but it's a great exposition of the meaning of liberalism. And if you were, for example, to go online and read what Mussolini had to say about liberalism and fascism, you know, Google Mussolini on fascism, the Italian dictator. He was a political philosopher. He had a PhD in political philosophy. And he knew that he had to really destroy the ideas of liberalism in the minds of Italians if he were to be successful in politics. And so all throughout his writings are attacks on free markets, on voluntary exchange, on all the ideas of liberalism, constitutional liberty, limited government, decentralized government, peace. These were all attacked by the fascists and communists and other socialists of the 20th century. And so there always has to be an ongoing ideological war against the ideas of liberalism, because after all, violence can be expensive, and violence can have blowback. People can revolt. You can run the risk of a revolution that will spoil everything for you by killing you and taking over your government if you're too brutal. And so brainwashing and propaganda has always been a part of the enforcement mechanism of exploitation by government, as is the manipulation of public opinion. I probably don't need to say much about that, but that takes place through the government control of the education system, government control of the communication system, and of course, in most public debates, government has such a big megaphone that it is able to drown out all other voices whenever it wants to. And so just how does this exploitation take place? Well, a major part of the means by which governments exploit their populations is collusion between a ruling elite and big business, especially bankers. And so this is where Rothbard got the ideas to do this type of research that is in his writings on the history of money and banking, and his power elite analysis of banksters and banksterism. It's the understanding that one, exploitation really is meaningless when you talk about the Marxian theory, capitalists exploiting the laborers, but exploitation is meaningful when you talk about government exploiting its population. And the mechanism for that, first and foremost, the major mechanism is the collusion between big business and big government at the expense of the well-being of the consumers and most other people in society. And bankers have always been a big part of this. If not, if they weren't the main colluders themselves with big government, there were other businesses, manufacturers, for example, who wanted a government takeover of banking and money because they understood that this would be useful to them in making profits in a political way, using politics to make profits. And for example, the dilemma that the mercantilists of Europe faced with the advent of the Industrial Revolution was they had their way. They had there was a big series of government-granted monopolies. There were protectionist tariffs and trade policy. There were corporate welfare subsidies all about, and the kings of Europe granted all sorts of monopolies so that the businesses would make monopoly profits, and the monopoly profits would be shared with the kings. It would be a way of indirectly taxing the population by allowing these monopolies to charge high monopolistic prices and then sharing the loot with the king. And so this existed. And then along came the factory system. And so along came the factory system, and the technology of the day, all of a sudden created a proliferation of manufacturers producing all sorts of products. Not just one monopoly in every town, a monopoly clothing manufacturer, a monopoly soap manufacturer, and so forth, as was the case in medieval Europe in generations after that. And so this broke up the whole mercantilist system, and a main ingredient of how this took place was the ideas of liberalism. The ideas of liberalism provided a culture of ideas that persuaded the public that this was good for them, that laissez-faire and the free market competition was good for them. They were no longer the victims of government-granted monopolies. They no longer had to rely on handouts from the state and from others. As bleak as the jobs in the factories were, they were better than 16 hours of backbreaking labor on the farm, which was the alternative to the people who moved en masse into the factories during the Industrial Revolution in Europe, and then later the Industrial Revolution in America. And so we had a period in history, the Industrial Revolution, that broke up this old system of crony capitalism or mercantilism. But politicians and business people never gave up the fight. They always wanted to bring this system back, and they always understood that a government bank, a bank run by politicians for the benefit of the politicians themselves and of private bankers, was a key to bringing back this corrupt system of mercantilism. And so that's a lot of American history is about the struggle between laissez-faire, moving in the direction anyway of laissez-faire, and in the opposite direction of mercantilism. And so what this collusion of business, big business and big government always led to was centralization of government and centralization of business, bigger and bigger business in smaller and smaller numbers of businesses being the most successful ones, concentration of industry, in other words, in cahoots with with government. And of course, sometimes this led to a foreign military intervention, but an important point that Hoppe makes in his article is that free market capitalism per se does not require military intervention to succeed. But what does require military intervention is the imposition of state-protected monopolies. So in the U.S. government has done all around the world in the 19th and 20th centuries, bombing various countries and taking over and acquiring Hawaii literally at gunpoint. They did so to impose a state-protected monopoly or monopolies in one or more industries, and that's mercantilism. And so we've had the imposition of mercantilism in foreign countries for the benefit of American corporations at gunpoint for a long, long time, being a part of American foreign policy, but that's not capitalism. Capitalism is just businesses going into these countries and saying, hey, we can offer you your consumers a better deal, or we can build a factory here and we can hire your workers. There was an article in the Journal of Labor Research several years ago, for example, by Ben Powell, who's an philosophy economist, graduated from George Mason, and a co-author. I forget who the co-author was at the moment. But they showed that in some Latin American countries, when American corporations opened up factories there, they increased wages by between 6 and 13 times, a six-fold to 13-fold times. And so that's what capitalism is, moving into countries like this, investing in other countries, and giving the people there pay raises to induce them to come and work for you and producing products that they value and that which they can afford. There's no need to send an army or a navy or an air force to bomb to force your way into that. People will welcome you in if you're going to give them jobs and cheap products. That's what capitalism does. And so there's a lot of confusion over this, mostly on the part of the academic left, which calls this capitalism, but it really is not. And of course, I guess as a rule of thumb, the weaker is the exploitative state, as Hoppe calls it, the more prosperous a society will be. So the more exploitation there is, the more government there is, the less prosperous any society will become. That's iron law number one of government, I would say. And so Rothbard's writings take this sort of exploitation analysis as their point of departure. And then, of course, he did a lot of really, really investigative research to find out who exactly a lot of the individuals were who were so influential. It's one thing to theorize about collusion between business and government, but it's a lot of hard work to find out just who and how this has taken place in history. And Rothbard did that. And this is one of the things I always really loved about Rothbard's research and writing, because unlike most economists, he was a hard worker, and he was very diligent and he persevered. And it's easy to get a higher degree in economics and sit around and theorize and learn a little bit of math and spin up theoretical model after theoretical model and have a career that way. But Rothbard, like so many of the other Austrians of the last generation, had this motivation in him of a relentless pursuit of the truth about history and economics. And that's what motivated him and drove him to write things like this. And I noticed that right away a long, long time ago when I was a student in the writings of people like Rothbard and von Mises and the other Austrians. And that's what drew me to them. That's what got me so interested in them, as opposed to the sort of the mainstream economics. Now, on money, it's useful to do as Rothbard does in his article that I put on the syllabus, to make keep in your mind the distinction between free market money and monetary socialism. The original definition of socialism was government ownership of the means of production. Money is an important vehicle of the means of production. And so when we have a central bank that monopolizes the money supply, what we have is monetary socialism. That's what it is. It's socialism in the monetary sphere. And just the way Rothbard puts it, I can find a quote here. Let's see. It was really good in his article. He says, It is no more a function of the state to regulate money and banking than it is a function of the state to regulate the growing and marketing of onions or anything else. If the state were to take over the onion industry, well, that would be socialism in the onion industry. If the state takes over healthcare, well, that would be healthcare socialism. If the state takes over the money supply, well, that's monetary socialism. And so that's what we've got in most of the world, all of the world today. But free market money is very, very different, of course. Money evolved on the free market. No government created money in history. Human beings decided what they would use for money, and they wanted things that would be durable, portable, and divisible. Those are the three main characteristics: portability, durability, and divisibility. And the whole world for 3,000 years settled on gold and silver, and primarily gold, as the best type of money that would satisfy those characteristics of money. And so in a free market economy, where the free market tells us what kind of money is best for us, and we tell ourselves that actually by choosing these things, here's how you can make a living. You can be a producer and a worker. You can work and produce goods and services and sell them for money. You can receive gifts, or you can be a gold or silver miner. Those are the three ways to make money. And so in terms of the gold mining, and say, you know, if we have gold as a source of money, Rothbard points out the economics of gold mining, and that there's no reason really to worry about the proliferation of gold by gold miners. Well, if we were to return to a pure gold standard, that would create inflation. And one of the things he points out is that, well, gold mining would be a business like any other business. And the tendency in manufacturing and mining and all businesses, all capitalism, is as long as there's competition, then the rates of return to investment tend toward equality. If any one industry is exceptionally profitable, resources will flow into that industry, entry will occur, more businesses will enter that business, and the increased supply that is the result will drive down prices, profits, and rates of return, so that the rate of return in that industry will not be any more exceptional than any other industry. And there's no reason to believe that this would not be true of gold mining, as well as everything else, as well as the manufacturing of automobiles and cigarettes and clothing or anything else. And so that's how the market would treat exceptional success in finding gold, and it would quell in any effect of gold mining or creating inflation. Okay, and so in a free market, that's basically how the free market works. And so the total amount of money supply is determined by the amount of resource, amount of gold. And of course, there's the velocity of money that the monetary theorists talk about. And that in terms of the efficacy of using gold, well, the gold turns over. We exchange goods and services, and there's a certain velocity of money. The number of times a dollar turns over in a given year, for example, today is called the velocity of money. And so, you know, in a nutshell, that's what free market money looks like. But of course, the state has always done everything it can to monopolize money, because the state recognizes that if it controls the money, that is the one way that it can destroy the nexus or the connection between working and producing and income. All of a sudden, if the state controls the money supply, some people can earn income. Oh, I shouldn't use the word earn. Can get a hold of income. Can have income without working and producing. The state itself, if it can print money, it can benefit. It can pay itself salaries and other benefits without actually working. And people who support the state, welfare beneficiaries or whatever, anybody who gets a state transfer from the state, also can get income without working. And so, and that, of course, is the way that the state enriches itself personally and keeps itself in power by using the printing up of money, the creation of money, as though it were magic, to buy political support, to buy votes and political support. And so that's why the state has always abrogated to itself a monopoly over monetary issues. That's the main reason. Here's what one of the things that Rothbard says about this. It says, if the state controls the money supply, then it can create new money and use it to increase its own expenditures on goods and services, as well as the expenditures of its favored subsidized groups in society. And so that's his way of saying the things that I just said. And then, of course, the printing of money as opposed to taxation creates some economists call a fiscal illusion. That is, it's a way of hiding or disguising the true costs of government. If taxes are direct and you know what you're paying, and they hit you in the pocketbook. But with the printing of money to finance government expenditures, if it does create price inflation eventually, well, then the government will wage a propaganda campaign to blame the inflation on greedy capitalists. It never, ever takes responsibility for the problems it creates, after all. And so it will blame the greedy capitalists. As Rothbard says this, the government can join the public in denouncing rising prices while conveniently overlooking its own total responsibility for the rising prices. And historically, that is what always has happened. Government creates the price inflation, and it uses that as an occasion to denounce capitalism in the current Great Recession that the world is still in. The American Fed created the housing bubble, the bubble burst. The government at all levels took that as an opportunity to denounce what? Not the creation of a bubble by the Fed, but capitalism, and to give itself vast new powers. Okay, and so in addition to that, the central banks then will denounce capitalism for creating inflation, which it itself created, and then on top of that, it will praise itself as an inflation fighter. It will say, "You need us. You need the central bank to fight the inflation that is caused by the greedy capitalist system." And that's how it works. And so, as Rothbard said, inflation is the health of the state. There's a famous essay that many of you may have heard of, the title "War is the Health of the State" by Randolph Bourne. But Rothbard, in his article that I put on the syllabus for tonight, says inflation is the health of the state. And one of the things that keeps this all going, not just the worshiping of the Fed, but the growth of government in general, is the common good mythology. The idea that what the government does is in the public interest or the common good or some variety of that sort of language. Hayek wrote about this in The Road to Serfdom in several places about how a key component of collectivism, whether it's called socialism, fascism, communism, the New Deal, whatever you want to call it, is to try to convince a large part of the public that what you, the government, are doing is in the common interest, the common good. Here's what Rothbard says. He says, to cloak the actions of the state in morally and aesthetically respectable forms, then the public must believe that these actions are motivated by zeal for, quote, the common good. That's where the intellectuals and the professors come in. The intellectuals, who are sort of the court historians for the state, their job is to write books and articles and give speeches about how faithful the government is to serving the common good. So if you were to look, for example, at several generations of Paul Samuelson's textbook entitled Economics, which was the biggest selling textbook in the world from 1948 into the 1980s, and look up what he says about the Fed, you'll have some version of how the Fed selflessly pursues the public interest by stabilizing the price level, fighting unemployment, and things of that sort. As Rothbard says, I'll quote him again, he says, it is a generally accepted myth that the Federal Reserve System, as in the case of other central banks, was established to stabilize the economy and check inflation. Actually, it was designed to promote inflation under the aegis of the central government. And of course, it certainly has. If you were to look at the government's own price inflation statistics The CPI is about 30 times higher today than it was when the Fed was created. One sort of final couple of points I'd like to make about on this particular discussion here is that the Fed, as I said earlier, it was just another example of the creation of a government-enforced cartel, of which there have been many. The Interstate Commerce Commission was created in 1887, and it enforced a cartel, pricing cartel, for the railroad companies. And then when the trucking industry came along, the Interstate Commerce Commission in America enforced a cartel arrangement for the benefit of the trucking companies. It actually set the prices the trucking companies could charge to haul freight, and it prohibited a truck driver from filling up his truck with another load after dropping off a load of something in a city in order to reduce the supply of trucking services and thereby increase the price of trucking services for the benefit of trucking companies and their employees at the expense of all consumers. Mercantilism, in other words. The Civil Aeronautics Board, when it was created, created a government-enforced cartel for the airline industry. There were more airlines in America in the 1920s than there were in the 1970s, thanks to the CAB, the Civil Aeronautics Board. And so the Fed was just yet another example of this phenomenon, where the bankers understood that if they issued a currency, a private currency, and they inflated that currency, if that currency was not backed by gold, and they simply printed enough money, then the currency issued by that particular bank would eventually become useless. People would catch on pretty quickly that the value had been devalued, the value had been deflated of the currency, and they will cash it in. They will make a run on the bank. They will want their gold back, and that bank will go bankrupt. And so to the extent that a system like that would create problems, the problems are very specific, very regional, very local. But once the government takes over the monetary system, then all banks can inflate at the same time, and the government itself will take care of them. It will be the lender of last resort, as it calls itself, and will make sure that no one goes bankrupt. And so individual banks cannot inflate under the gold standard without serious negative repercussions, bankruptcy. But under a monetary system whereby the government monopolizes the money supply, that's a cartel. That's a government-enforced cartel for the benefit of the banks. And they can all inflate, and they don't suffer the bankruptcy problem in a genuinely competitive free market money situation. And that's exactly what the Fed did. And that's what government-controlled banking is all about. And that's really the essence of monetary socialism. As Rothbard further says, in banking, which has as its principal raw material the most important of all commodities, money, we have adopted socialism. So it's essentially socialism when the government takes it over. And so in terms of power elite analysis, Rothbard sort of gets into a bit of power elite analysis when he talks about these historical examples in this article that I put on the syllabus for tonight. From Modern Age magazine, and the historical examples are from the United States, of course. And so I think the most telling one is, and I'm going to talk more about this as we go along in the course, is he mentions a man named Nicholas Biddle. Nicholas Biddle was the president of the first Bank of the United States. It was a precursor of the Fed. It was originally created in 1791. And it was the sort of the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton, America's first Treasury Secretary. And Biddle was a devotee of Hamiltonian economics. And what does that mean? Well, Hamilton coined the phrase the American system to describe his preferred type of economic policy, which was the type of economic policy preferred by his political party, the Federalist Party. And then after they became defunct, the Whig Party in America in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, and then the Republican Party after that, during the Lincoln administration and past that in history. And this so-called American system was really nothing but British mercantilism brought to America. It involved high protectionist tariffs, tax-funded subsidies for road building, canal building, and then eventually railroad corporations. It involved a government-run bank run by politicians on the nation's capital that would be partly capitalized or mostly capitalized, in theory anyway, by private investors, but for the benefit of the private investors and the government, and a big public debt. So corporate welfare, protectionist tariffs, central banking, and high public debt were the characteristics of the so-called American system. And Rothbard quotes Nicholas Biddle as being a devotee of the American system, and indeed he was. And so all of the politicians in American history who advocated this system, and this was a big part of the American political arena from the time of the American founding until the final success of all of this corrupt mercantilist system during the Lincoln administration, and Nicholas Biddle played a big part of it. And so they always understood that they needed a bank run by politicians. They needed the government takeover of the money supply because they wanted to adopt a system of crony capitalism. They wanted to destroy real capitalism, and they wanted to adopt a British-style system of crony capitalism funded by a central bank. And that always was the reason for the bank. And so in terms of the power elite analysis, Rothbard points out that Biddle was sort of the front man for a lot of corporate interests in America. And here's one of the things he says. He says, the Pennsylvania iron and steel industry was in the forefront of the battle for protectionism and for greenback inflationism. And so he's talking about the 19th century, once we had the greenbacks in America. That was in the 1860s. So we have manufacturers in favor of and supporting a central bank and the creation of price inflation by the central bank. And he goes on to say the Pennsylvanians realized that in a period of inconvertible greenback money, inflation, and the consequent depreciation of greenbacks compared to gold and foreign exchange was the equivalent of a protective tariff. It made American exports look cheaper. In its artificial cheapening of American exports and making dear American imports. So these manufacturers always understood that the creation of price inflation would make their products look cheaper to overseas buyers. And it would boost exports, and also it would make imports look more expensive. And so they always saw inflation, price inflation, as a way of sort of backdoor protectionism. And therefore, manufacturers of this sort were always big proponents of central banking, of bringing back the Bank of the United States after President Andrew Jackson vetoed it out of business in the late 1830s. And to go on to what Rothbard says, he says this, the cause of protectionism and inflation was also persistently backed by the American Iron and Steel Association, the Union Meeting of American Iron Masters, the American Industrial League, composed largely of Pennsylvania iron masters, and its organ, the Industrial Bulletin, was a publication. And he names names, too. He talks about Jay Cook. He says, Jay Cook was a recipient of government land grants in his railroad ventures. This was after the American Civil War. And he benefited from inflation and credit expansion that drove up the price of land. And so these are some of the early examples that Rothbard offers in his publication of what he calls power elite analysis. People like Jay Cook being very closely linked to the government and using his connections in government to promote central banking, inflationism, protectionism, all for his benefit, the benefit of his business associates at the expense of the consumers and of the public in general. And so that's, Rothbard's early power elite analysis in this one article that I put on the syllabus for tonight. And I'll read his conclusion in this. He says, inflationism and state control of the monetary system have in many critical periods of American history been proposed and established not by workers and farmers, that's what some of the historians say, but by groups of merchants, manufacturers, and other businessmen eager to acquire special privilege to use the state for their own advantage. In short, by men who are essentially modern mercantilists. And so those are the things that the points I wanted to make for tonight to sort of set the stage for the study of Rothbard's more detailed writings on power elite analysis of the monetary system is understanding what exploitation is in the Austrian theory, and understanding point number two, that exploitation, the main form of it, is collusion between business and government. And then point number three is that the business people and government politicians who always wanted to play this game of exploiting the public always understood that a government takeover of the monetary system was the essential tool to keep exploitation going. And so the abolition or the privatization of money, the abolition of monetary socialism or the abolition of central banking, therefore, is a prerequisite for having a genuine free market capitalism. And this, of course, is one of the points that causes a lot of economists, even if they fancy themselves as being free market economists, to distance themselves from Rothbard, because it's logical, it's true, but the Fed has become, and the central banks have become such cherished institutions in academia, that it can be bad for your career, I suppose, if you're too critical of the Fed. But as I said, Rothbard was never concerned about being criticized by other academics. He was concerned about the relentless pursuit of the truth in the spirit of Ludwig von Mises. That's always what he was first and foremost concerned with. And I think I'll stop there. I've been going on for about 45 minutes. This is usually what I'll try to do, because I think most people are kind of weary of any kind of talk after 45 minutes or so. But I'll be glad to try my best to answer whatever questions you may have. You're not forced to have questions. We're all about laissez-faire around here. But if you have some questions on this, I'll do my best to see what I can do to answer them. And I'll look at the chat, and I'll also look at the Q&A on my screen here. Oh, thanks to Danny and Cam for doing a great job as always. I see all these links that they've dug up. This is a great way to learn for people who want to learn. I mentioned these things in passing. I've spent 33 years reading all this stuff and researching it and writing books about it. And when I sort of spit these things out, it's great to have people like Danny and Cam find the links to these things so that the students can just look them up. I'll keep looking around if you have any questions. You don't have to ask questions. It's all laissez-faire around here. Leslie wants to know which edition of Samuelson was the worst in the phrase of the Fed. Oh, well, the earlier editions, I think, tended to be really bad. I read an article a long time ago in a magazine called Policy Review. It was published by the Heritage Foundation. This was around 1988-89, around there. And it was, I think the title was Triumph of the Free Market Textbooks. And what I did was, at that point in the 80s, some of the economics textbooks that had been published, like the one by Jim Gortney and Richard Stroop, another one by Richard McKenzie and Gordon Tullock, were very much more free market oriented than Samuelson. And so I wrote an article in Policy Review about the big market share that had been taken away from Samuelson by these more free market oriented economics, principles of economics books. And in the course of doing that, I, I surveyed all of the existing Samuelson books, and the early ones are truly awful. And it's very easy. If you, one of the articles of mine that I put on this, the syllabus for this class, I think it's next week. It's The Myth of the Independent Fed by me. And in that article, I quote some one of Samuelson's books, a public interest story about the Fed sort of selflessly pursues the public interest. Another equally horrible book of the time was one by Campbell McConnell. It was the second biggest selling book of the era, and it also had these ridiculous infantile rantings about the public interest seeking Fed. And so that is it. That's what I would look for, some of the earlier ones. But just about anyone will be pretty ridiculous. Let's see, Travis wants to know, would conservative Republicans like Romney be considered a modern mercantilist? I would say yes, nothing but. The Republican Party has always been the party of mercantilism. It began with the Lincoln administration was the final victory of the Hamiltonian mercantilists, with the high protectionist tariffs that lasted for 65 years, corporate welfare run amok with railroad subsidies and so forth. And so, but both parties are like this now, of course. The Democrats are in the same boat as Republicans, and that they all kowtow to big business, and they all acquire millions and millions of dollars from big businesses in return for all sorts of special favors and corporate welfare, explicit and implicit. And so, yeah, the Republicans, I would say, though, 30 years ago, it was primarily the Republicans. But ever since Bill Clinton was president, the Democrats got into the act much more than they used to. Yes, they are more nationalistic than the Democrats seem to be. The Democrats are pretty much socialists. They're all about socialism. I call it Obamianism. But yeah, most of the Republicans seem to be nationalists, which is very dangerous. You know, Nazi Germany was based on that economic nationalism. The difference between the Nazis and the Soviet communists is that the Soviet communists called themselves international socialists, whereas the Nazis called themselves national socialists. And so all this talk about autarky, that is autarky, or self-sufficiency in oil or whatever other product you're talking about, that's economic nationalism. Of course, that means you're proposing to isolate ourselves from the international division of labor and the benefits thereof. That can be very dangerous economically, very destructive. But that's sort of the big idea of the Sean Hannitys and the Rush Limbaughs of the world and the so-called neoconservatives who are Republicans. See, Paul is asking about the word liberal. Well, the word liberal comes from liberty. It has a long history. As I said, read at least the first half of von Mises's book, Liberalism, if you want to understand what it is. And that word was stolen by socialists in the early 20th century, and who started calling themselves liberal because the idea was so popular in America. Everyone wanted to be in favor of freedom, so they stole that word. But it has a totally opposite meaning of the original meaning. Let's see, Phil is asking mainstream economists like Meltzer and Rajan at Chicago, write whole books explaining the crisis in terms of education gap between the classes, et cetera, saying the government failed, but advocating that the government step up as a solution. Surely they are not part of the conspiracy, but when did this thinking, government solutions, begin in academia? Government solutions in academia. Well, I think the whole idea of government as problem solver was hatched during the American Civil War. If you were to read Jeffrey Hummel's book entitled Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men, the history of the American Civil War has a lot of economics in it. It's not just a the account of the battles and the generals and things like that. But in the last chapter, he writes about the legacies of the American Civil War, and including the economic legacies and political legacies. One of them is this idea of government as problem solver. And so with the progressive takeover of education by government after the American Civil War, I think it was inevitable that you would have academics talking persistently about government as problem solver. Now, Phil mentioned the Chicago School. One of the differences between the Chicago School and the Austin School is the Chicago School economists, at least when there was a Chicago School. Nowadays, I understand a lot of the Chicago economists are just sort of technicians from MIT, like everybody else. But when they were interested in real interesting topics back in the days of Milton Friedman and George Stigler and people of that sort, Gary Becker is still there, I guess. They were critics of the Fed. There were all sorts of critics of the Fed, but it was forbidden to challenge the very existence of the Fed. They were good critics of antitrust regulation, but they were forbidden from writing articles and published articles challenging the whole existence of antitrust laws, as quite a few Austrians do, as being inherently incompatible with free market competition. And so that's sort of this Chicago modus operandi to pretty much say, yes, the Fed has failed, but put smart guys like us from Chicago in charge and we'll fix it. Or, yes, the antitrust laws have been counterproductive for 120 years, but if smart guys and gals like us at the University of Chicago were put in charge of them, they would be better. The Austrians are not so naive and foolish as to believe that. And so you don't see quite as much of this. Most Austrians don't see themselves as advisors to politicians, nor do Virginia School of Public Choice economists, because they understand that politicians will only take your advice if they think it will enhance their power and money. If the advice you give them will not do that, they will not take your advice, and your advice will be wasted. Let's see. Helen has asked, says the Democrats and Republicans seem to have been successful. Well, yeah, they use brute force. You know, once you have a government the size we do, you know, you have these people like Obama or Romney or whoever who would rise to power. They gain control of 200 and some years of accumulated bureaucratic powers. It's easy to be successful if you can bomb your opponents overseas, and if you can jail your opponents or censor them here at home, or intimidate them in other ways, and if you can use the vast resources of income taxation and money creation to bribe just about anybody to support you, whether it's governors and states in general, or individuals with student loans and farm subsidies and so forth. Yeah, they're successful. They're not successful because their ideas are the best ideas. They're successful because they have inherited the accumulated powers of force, fraud, intimidation, and coercion that define government. That's why they've been, quote, successful. However, as Rothbard points out in one of his great essays is called Anatomy of the State, which is online on Mises.org, is that all governments, no matter how tyrannical, even the Soviet communists, always understood that their power really rested and relied upon the public believing in a series of myths about their benevolence and about how they pursued the common interest, the common good, and so forth, and some auxiliary myths about the alleged evils of private enterprise, free markets, and the civil society. But once the public comes to disbelieve these things, then it's over, and their power is gone. That's what happened in the Soviet Union, finally. And so even the most powerful and tyrannical governments with the most guns and money and so forth, that's why they rely on a set of intellectuals, of court historians and other intellectuals who provide this propaganda, this fog of propaganda about the need for the state, the benevolence of the state, and all the myths of the state about the sainted Abraham Lincoln and the sainted Franklin Roosevelt and on and on and on, and the evils of capitalism. That's what state power relies on. And that's why educating yourself by learning Austrian economics is the first step toward countering this, because ideas do matter. If ideas didn't matter, the state would not spend so much time filling the heads of the public with bad ideas. Rami mentions that here in the old continent, the term liberalism means classical liberalism. Well, still, if you were to read The Economist magazine, which has been published was published in England well over 100 years ago, over 150 years ago, it was published. The Economist magazine had a running commentary on the events of the American Civil War. They still, to this day, when they use the word liberal or liberalism, which they do in every issue, they refer to the old European definition of liberalism, basically a libertarian. And of course, in America, a liberal is a socialist. Let's see, the American oil situation, Bob Shaw. I'm not a big expert on the American oil industry per se, but I do know that we have a tremendous amount of oil reserves in Alaska and elsewhere. But we also have an environmentalist lobby that has several billion dollars a year in budget. These are private lobbying groups. And they are totally in the pocket of the Obama administration. And so I don't think there's any hope of them freeing up additional exploration or drilling of oil. And of course, the constant meddling, foreign policy meddling in the Middle East creates tremendous uncertainty over oil supplies. And so if the U.S. government would just shut up and go home and leave these people alone in the Middle East, there'd be a tremendous increase in certainty, or a drop in uncertainty about oil supplies coming from the Middle East. We can engage in more peaceful and profitable trade, free international trade with them and others. But that doesn't seem to be on the horizon either. And so government policy deprives Americans of a huge supply of oil and natural gas through government regulation. And the oil and natural gas that is developed in America is so heavily regulated and taxed that the supply would probably be orders of magnitude bigger were it not taxed and regulated so heavily. And so basically government policy is to shoot ourselves in the foot with regard to oil and natural gas, all in the name of, I guess, fighting global warming. It would be the excuse that is given. And so, just in general, that's what I would say about the oil situation. But as I said, I'm not an expert in the details of the oil industry. Let's see, Leslie is asking about mercantilism is the cause of World War II. The U.S. government did have a policy of depriving the Japanese of oil. They were blockading Japan, keeping Japan. And Japan has no oil. There's not a drop of oil in Japan, and so that was part of the American policy. And so, Anglo-American mercantilism. The Germans, there's a long story to tell about World War II and the causes of World War II. But the Germans adopted the policy of autarky, or trying to be self-sufficient in their own resources. Of course, the country of Germany itself did not have enough resources to be self-sufficient in producing everything. And that's what made them decide they had to conquer their neighbors to be self-sufficient in their empire that they wanted to amass. The Nazi Party, anyway, I shouldn't say Germans in general, but And that was, of course, a disaster. And that was a major reason for war in the 20th century, was this pursuit of self-sufficiency by such people as the Nazi Party, once they gained control of the government. And as far as, Robert Higgs has written a lot about this on World War II. I would, look at his writing, look at his writings on the web on this question. He would be our foremost authority, I think, on this. He kind of likes the phrase participatory fascism to describe the current political situation in America, as opposed to mercantilism. There's an article by Ivan Elin that Cam put up. Ivan Elin is a good researcher at the Independent Institute in California. And so I would recommend his writings for sure. we're going to talk about this when I get into Rothbard's writings. Danny put on a quote from Rothbard in the Rockefellers, from his article on the Rockefellers. That's in the essay that's on the reading list for 2 weeks from now, that Danny just put up on the chat. Let's see, Taylor has another question here. What do I make of characters such as Noam Chomsky, who, like us, realize that the state and crony capitalism are the roots of most of the world's ills, and seem to pretend that the Fed doesn't exist? Well, people like that are just not educated in economics, let alone Austrian economics. And so, so a guy like Chomsky is a very highly intelligent person. He has good instincts about these things. But if you were just study economics a little bit, I think you would be much better and realize about the role of the Fed in bankrolling all these wars. The Wall Street banks and American foreign policy is on the syllabus for a couple weeks from now. We'll talk about it in much more detail. Okay, anything? See if there's anything under the Q&A that's different. Okay, Michael says he developed a new name for America, corruptilism. Okay, we'll see if that flies. I coined the phrase fascialism to describe our economic system, and it's part fascism and part socialism. One of our friends tried to get a Wikipedia entry for fascialism, but they vetoed him. Let's see, Michael asked about a consumption tax. Well, a consumption tax turns out to be a tax on savings also, because it ends up taxing your income, and people save part of their income. And so there's really no distinction between a consumption tax and an income tax for all practical purposes. So adopting a so-called consumption tax is really just rearranging the chairs on the deck of the Titanic, as far as that goes. Whenever politicians talk about tax reform, by the way, they always insist on revenue neutrality, which is to say, under no circumstances should government ever take in a penny less next year than this year. And the real tax on the population is measured better by government spending. And how much government spends is a measure of how many resources are extracted from the private sector of the economy, one way or the other. And it doesn't really matter that much whether it's consumption tax, income tax, capital gains tax. The differences are really, really minor. For some reason, conservatives are enamored by a national sales tax. But in my course on the Rothbardian analysis of the state, I devote a whole evening to a discussion of Rothbardian economics of taxation. including a critique of consumption taxes. Okay, I'll go back to the chat. Q&A rather. Okay, I don't see any more chatting going on here. Where is let's see, I see a question from Travis. How do libertarians explain successfully to others that we do not belong to the right or the left? People believe capitalism on the right, but I believe it belongs to liberty. Today's vernacular is really useless because the people who run the Republican Party are basically fascists, and the people who run the Democratic Party are basically socialists. So one of my articles on LouRockwell.com before the 2008 election was, I think the title was Fascist or Socialist, Take Your Pick. And I quoted John McCain, as saying things were very similar to what Benito Mussolini used to say. And then I quoted Obama in his share the wealth socialism lingo. And so that's pretty much what you've got. And so stick to substance. Talk about substance and ideas. Don't talk about labels. So Ethan says, people don't believe in isms. Well, the fact of the matter is, the English language has used the word protectionism for several hundred years, and so the fact that someone says, I don't believe in it, is irrelevant. That's sort of a foolish and stupid thing to say, because the fact is the rest of the world does. So if you want to engage in a conversation about important economic issues that the rest of the world has been talking about for several hundred years, after all, protectionism was a key target of Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776. So that's what I would say to people who say things like that. Bob wants to know what sequester is. Sequester is a word invented by one of Obama's lawyers to confuse the public into thinking who knows what. It has no meaning, sequester. I've written books and books about federal government budgeting. The first one was in 1983, and this year is the first year I've heard this word sequester referred to in terms of the budget. And so it's just a propaganda word designed to pull the wool over the public's eyes about what they're doing. It's meaningless. Okay, Ethan is laughing out loud. That's good. Let's take one more jab at Q&A here. And Travis wants to know, how do we achieve how do we achieve freedom? Well, we have to rely on the division of labor. You know, I'm a professor and a book writer and a speaker. You do your thing, I do my thing, and there's no secret recipe for achieving that. We can study history, we can study economics and ideas, and that certainly is a prerequisite, because when the time comes, you have to have competing ideas. When the time comes to change the system, you have to have something better to persuade people with. Or else they'll rely on some bad ideas that are out there. Yeah, corporatism was there was a question from Rami. It was a big part of fascism. a huge part of Italian fascism was bailouts, bailouts of corporations, because what economic fascism was private property and private enterprise was allowed, but it was very heavily controlled and regimented by the state, and it had to serve purposes defined for it by the state. And so once the state sort of took over de facto control of all these corporations, it did not want to admit that they were failing. So when they did fail economically and failed to earn profits, there were massive subsidies, just as we have massive subsidies today in America for the big banks and others. And so, you know, we, in a very real sense, we have adopted Italian-style fascism in America as our economic system. Zachary or Bob is calling tonight. Let's see. Zachary wants to read liberalism. That's a good idea for everybody in the class. Modern liberalism and libertarianism, the same intellectual forebears. Oh, no. Liberalism in America today, the forebears are more like Rousseau and Karl Marx, whereas classical liberalism would be John Locke and Adam Smith and Lord Acton, people of that sort, just polar opposites. David is asking about freedom in banking. The government throughout the 19th century always had some sort of hand in regulating banking, if not running a government bank. The first bank in the United States was defunded in 1811, and then it was resurrected in 1817, and then it was defunded again in the late 1830s by Andrew Jackson, and then the government passed legal tender laws and national currency acts in the 1860s. And so, and state governments regulated banking too. So there is some sort of regulation by government of banks and money all throughout the 19th century. But the period between 1840 and 1862, some people call the free banking era, because there was no national bank, and it was relatively unregulated banking at that point. Herbert Spencer is a famous libertarian too, of yesteryear. I think Roderick Long, who's a philosophy professor at Auburn University, who participates in a lot of Mises Institute events and has for many years, knows a great deal about Herbert Spencer. And I think if you look Roderick up on the web, you'll probably find some of his favorite writings by Herbert Spencer. Well, I think libertarian socialism is an oxymoron, kind of like military intelligence or jumbo shrimp. So I have no idea what it would mean. Okay, any more questions here? We'll look at the Q&A one more time. Let's see, David, that was the economy like during the period of free banking. Well, there was still slavery, and so we didn't have totally free labor by any means in 1840 to 1860. And that was always a drag on the southern economy, especially because slave labor is inherently less productive than free labor. But as far as the capital markets were concerned, they were much freer and more efficient than they would have been if they were under greater government control. Although governments did do enough meddling, in state governments included, during that period. And so the advocates of central banking point to the fact that there were a few of the so-called wildcat banks during that time. They would issue a currency, and they would say, well, yes, you can redeem the currency in gold, but only at this branch located at this location. And that location would be out in the middle of nowhere, where it was said only a wildcat or a mountain lion would exist. And so, and of course, some of these were the banks that were run by frauds or crooks, and they did go bankrupt because the people didn't trust their money. And so the people who are the enemies of free markets have always pointed to the few examples of crooks and con men who were in the banking business during this era and essentially lied about it and said, well, this is what happened. They were wildcat banks. And you want people to think that this was, existed everywhere. But if you think about how competition works, that's ridiculous. It would be in your interest to make money to have a sound currency, because the unsound currencies, no one was doing their banking there. No one was doing business with them. And people wanted to do business with sound banks, and they did. So it was a relatively good period. In fact, Richard Timberlake, who wrote one of the few real big treatises on the history of monetary theory and policy in America, says that this was probably the most stable monetary system in all of American history, the 1840 to 1862. And that's Richard Timberlake's opinion. I'll look at the chat one more time here. Let's see, Leslie wants to know what the powers that be are going to do against Ron Paul and the Fed movement. Well, they already did it. Yeah, you saw how they treated Ron Paul and the Fed movement. But on the other hand, it's very interesting, isn't it, that Ron really created some huge enemies among the most powerful politicians in America. He got their attention. And the Fed movement, which is comprises many millions of people, many young people especially, has really got their attention and has them scared and shaken in their boots. And I think this is a great thing, and I'd like to see it become much bigger and frighten the wits out of these guys a lot and gals a lot more than it has already. Hopefully Ron Paul will continue on in his radio show and other things to continue frightening these people. Ron is sort of like a guy who's carrying a Christian cross in front of an army of Draculas when he talks about liberty and freedom and ending the Fed. Okay, well, I think we're running about out of time. It's getting close to 7 o'clock, folks, in my watch, and I don't see any more questions here. And we're sort of getting off the topic of power elite analysis also with Ron Paul and so forth, although I'm glad to answer questions of that sort. So I think we'll call it a night, and thanks for participating. I hope you all learned something, and I'll do my best to maximize your learning opportunity in the next 4 or 5 weeks. So have a good night.